So there's a real transition here because we're moving to Perek Chaf Aleph of Sefer Shmuel Beis, and we've wrapped up the long, long story that began. You know, one way of thinking of it was there's like concentric circles. There was the David Avshalom story, which is the longest single narrative in Sefer Shmuel. That went back all the way to Perek Yud Gimel. So that was eight prakim. Then one way of thinking about it was the whole Avshalom rebellion was just the postscript to the Uriah and Bathsheba story. So that takes us back to Perek Yud Aleph. Then we saw the truth was the Uriah and Bathsheba was preceded by the way the Navi presented David's meteoric rise. And basically everything has been pretty much in chronological order, give or take, from the beginning of Shmuel Beis. Parakhaf Aleph, there's a total shift. The Abarbanel happens to be argues that our Parak happened after the rebellion of Avshalom, and this is in chronological order. But the Pshat really seems to be that this is all stuff which happened much earlier in David's reign, right? David is going to be fighting against the Plishtim in the second half of the Parak, and we kind of finished off the Plishtim way back in Perek Ches. Perek Ches, we finished off the Plishtim. So it sounds like we had the whole Uriah, Bathsheba, Avshalom, Sheva ben Bichri narrative. We ended the previous Perek where the Navi restated David's cabinet, and the Radak had the comment. He said it's like David had been crowned again. And so now that we've restored peace, right, the first time the Navi gave us David's cabinet was after David defeated all of Bnei Yisrael's external enemies. And then happens again after David comes back into Eretz Yisrael, all the parallels to Yehoshua. They've reconquered the land, reestablished the Malchus, gotten rid of the, you know, Sefer Shoftim ethos of Sheva ben Bichri, who wanted to replace monarchy with anarchy. And chronologically, we could basically put a pin in Shmuel Beis Perek Chaf. That is the end of that chronological piece. And now we have a few, we've four prakim to conclude the Perek. The Dat Mikra points out that it's very clear that it's all one unit. They're in it's in a clear chiastic structure where you have, we begin with punishment from Hashem in this Perek. Then we have a song from David next week, another song after that, and then another punishment finishing off the story. And then the Sefer ends with David purchasing Har Habayis from Aravna the Kusi, the Yavusi, sorry, which again, probably happened long, 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 long ago. Rav Yaakov Midan has an interesting suggestion I saw in his notes. He says, we know the Gemara tells us that there were three Nevi'im who composed Sefer Shmuel. Shmuel, then Nasan HaNavi, and Gad HaChozeh. Rav Midan suggests that we know Nasan was very active in the previous unit. He was the one who gave the Nevuah to David about Yerushalayim and Har Habayis. Then he was the one who gave David the parallel Nevuah about the punishment that's going to happen for Uriah and Bathsheba. So Rav Midan suggests that that whole previous unit in Sefer Shmuel was basically Nasan's contribution to Sefer Shmuel. And now the last four prakim, we're going to have Gad HaChozeh is going to show up, I think, in Perek Chavdalid, and that this is his contribution, these few prakim over here. Or actually, it's one of his contributions, because Gad also was active earlier in Sefer Shmuel Aleph, when David was on the run as a fugitive, so Gad was with him out in the wilderness. That's just, you know, from a 20,000-foot perspective, as we are 50,000 how many feet up in the air, the way to think of this is that this is a new unit, not really connected either conceptually or chronologically to what we had before. Now, all that being said, as we're going to open up Sukkot now, hopefully we'll get through the whole parak today. It is a very challenging parak. It bothered Chazal a lot. There are some pretty wild theories about it out there, but we'll do the best that we can. So the Navi tells us there was a famine for 3 years in the time of David. David wants to know why it was. And David is told, Vayomer Hashem el Shaul ve'el beis hadamim asher himis es hagivonim. Shaul, the house of blood, which seems to refer to Shaul because he killed the Givonim. Now again, it makes a lot of sense that this is happening early in David's reign, right? If this is, you know, 25, 30 years of David's reign, why is Hashem only punishing Bnei Yisrael for something that happened with Shaul so long into David's reign. You see, the pshat really is that this happened a long time ago. But what exactly was it that happened? So there are two main strains of thought we can identify. Rashi brings both, and we'll see how they both really run through the entire paragraph. So the one thing to think about, Chazal definitely put this front and center, is the idea that there is punishment here for the aftermath of Nov Ir HaKohen, the massacre of the Mishkan, which was done by Shaul, really in many ways Shaul's greatest crime. Rashi explains that's why it's called Beis HaDamim, the bloody house, because he wiped out the city of Nov. And what happened here, so Rashi explains, when were the Givonim killed? So says Rashi, Kesharag Nov Ir HaKohanim Yimis Mehem Shiva. So he killed some Givonim as well. Nov is smack right near the city of Givon. So follow the reason, there are Givonim there. The Givonim also were put to work by Yehoshua. So they were slapping stuff in the Mishkan. So they were collateral damage. And now as a punishment for that, Hashem brings a famine, right? That's one approach. Now, there's ask a clear question on this. Why would Hashem only be punishing Bnei Yisrael for Shaul killing Givonim and not for Shaul killing Kohanim? You know, but that's one line that's here. And we're going to see Mishkan references throughout the parak. But Rashi himself and Radak as well points out that there is another piece. And it really comes, sorry for spoiling so much, from Parak Beis and from Pasuk Beis and Pasuk Hei. Pasuk Beis, the king says to the Givonim, right? And the Nabi tells us, that Givonim lo b'nei Yisrael ema, right? I mean, that makes a big deal about this. This is going to be the key things in the parak. The Givonim are not from B'nai Yisrael. They're from the leftover Emorim. You know, Yehoshua got rid of most of them, didn't get rid of all. We know the reason why they're still around is because they made a peace treaty with Yehoshua under false pretenses. The Navi references that over here, B'nai Yisrael nishbu lahem. B'nai Yisrael made an oath, right? They pretended to live far away because they wanted to remain in Eretz Yisrael without having to take on the Sheva Mitzvos B'nai Noach. So they deceived Yehoshua into a peace treaty. And then, sorry, once you make a Shvua, you have to keep it. Or at least that was the Kiddush Hashem that Yehoshua held himself to. Could it be? They could have said there was a deception here. And could he have gotten the lawyers involved and tried to get himself out of the Shvua? Maybe. That's a story per se for Yehoshua. But from the point we are at now, B'nai Yisrael took the oath very seriously, right? And allowed the Givonim to remain in the land. But then the Navi says, Vayvakei Shaul lahakosam. Shaul tried to kill them, bekanoso livnei Yisrael v'yuda, in his zeal for Yisrael and Yehuda. Now, the Navi in Shmuel Aleph did not give us any evidence of this. This is yet another example we have of how the Navi did not dwell on a lot of the activity of Sefer Shaul. Remember, way back during this last year, in the middle of the year, Shmuel Aleph Perek Yudalit, at the end of a very long Perek, the Navi had like three psukim where it said, by the way, Shaul worked very hard fighting against all of Bnei Yisrael's enemies everywhere. You know, the Plishtim, which does get attention in the psukim, but also Ammon and Moab and Aram and Edom. Shaul is very busy, a very active and a very successful king. And here is yet another example of this, where we have, oh, turns out that Shaul fought apparently against the Givonim. And this idea that Shaul actually attacked the Givonim, there wasn't just collateral damage, but there was direct warfare against them, is pretty clearly implied in Pasuk Hey as well. Because David turns to the Givonim and he says, what can I do for you to atone? B'me achaper, what can I do to atone for what was done? U'barchu es nachalas Hashem. And the Givonim say, we don't want money, we don't want silver, we don't want gold. Hazal make a big deal out of this. We want revenge. We want to kill Shaul's descendants. And then they say, Ha'isha asher kilanu, asher dimalanu, nishmadnu, v'yisaseh v'chol gvul Yisrael. And so it sounds like Shaul destroyed them. He wiped them out and he eliminated them from the land of Israel. So again, we have one strand of thought here. Shaul is being punished for killing Givonim in the context of the massacre of the city of Nob. Now we have what seems to be the pshat in Pasuk Beis and Pasuk Hey that Shaul had actually made war on the Givonim. And look and see, you'll see that both Rashi and the Radak are aware of this. Rashi has this here, Bikanaso Livnei Yisrael. Shaul tried to kill the Givonim in his attempt to cleanse and to purify Bnei Yisrael. And Rashi says this is a good kinah, right? You could have a good zealotry and a bad one. It's Parshas Balak, right? So coming up on Pinchas, Bekanoas kinasi. So you could definitely can have a positive kinah, and that Rashi says is the pshat of what Shaul was trying to do over here. Why would he want to wipe out Givon? And you see, Radak says the same thing. Radak says, according to the pshat, lo ne'amar devar Givonim al no ir ha-kohanim. Rather, it was about a war that Shaul made on the Plishtim. Says, on the Givonim, sorry. So he's fighting the Plishtim, but no, we're fighting the Givonim. And we can understand why he'd want to do this. He says, sheramu es Yisrael v'ganvu es da'atam b'ta'us. They deceived us. He kills him, he expels him. He says, we want a right or wrong. Rashi says, we don't want Canaan living in Eretz Yisrael. We know what a disaster that's going to be. All the Sefer Devar, Moshe Rabbeinu tells Bnei Yisrael, get rid of the Canaanim, get rid of the Canaanim, they're going to be a disaster. All of Sefer Shoftim, we're told, they didn't mop up getting rid of the Canaanim. They were a disaster. So Rashi and Radak explain that what happens here is that Shaul says, I want to finish the job. Right, and it's a very we could see this is like so classic Shaul. He has good reasons to do what he's doing. He has good, healthy motivations. The Givonim, and we're going to see the Givonim are horrible. They are cruel. They are perverse. They are ethically, morally Canaanim through and through. The hundreds of years that they've spent living with Bnei Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael since time of Yeshua has not made an ounce of difference. For Shaul to want to get rid of them is completely understandable, and we can understand why he thought he was doing something good, right? But as was so often the case with Shaul, doing what he thought was right, and maybe even for good reasons, at the end of the day was not what the will of Hashem was. And we knew for hundreds of years, Bnei Yisrael made a shvua, they were held to it. Yeshua was held to his oath. He came in Parak Yud and Sefer Yeshua to help defend the Givonim against the other Canaanim who attacked them. And Hashem miraculously gave them a victory. The fact that the Givonim have absolutely no gratitude and this hasn't impacted on them doesn't matter. An oath is an oath. Swearing in the name of Hashem has major consequences. And this was another example of how Shaul did not take that so seriously. Shaul swears in the name of Hashem a couple of times. He swears to kill Yonasan after Yonasan eats a little bit of honey. That gets voided pretty quickly. He swears he's not going to harm David. He swears that to Yonasan. That goes out the way pretty quickly. And here we have something else. Where Shaul, so complex, right? He's trying very hard. He wants to help in Esau. He realizes that these Givonim are a noxious presence. But what he tries to do about it, at the end of the day, it's a case where the ends are not going to justify the means. And Hashem makes that clear with the famine, which is brought over here. Now, there's one other piece. This is a little bit speculative, but I should have put the pasuk in Divrei HaYamim in the source sheet. But Shaul's grandfather in Divrei HaYamim is referred to as the father of Givon. What that means is that he was the most important person in the territory of Givon. Givon lives in Shevet Ben Yamin. They are in Shaul's backyard, right? So that means, on the one hand, that Shaul has a very intimate awareness of the problematic nature of these lingering Givonim. These people have a history with each other. At the same time, there also could be some personal motivations. You know, you get rid of the Givonim, they're living in your home turf. So this could be another example of some personal advantage, you know, impacting Shaul's decision. But that's a little bit more speculative. Okay, so be that as it may, we have two main ways to think about why the Givonim were killed, the drash that it has to do with no ir hakohanim, and the pshat that it has to do with Shaul making direct war on the Givonim. And then the Givonim make this shocking request. Right? The Givonim say, we don't want money, we don't want silver, we don't want gold, we want to kill, right? We want to destroy Shaul and his house. So, right, they tell him, yutan lanu shiva anashim mibanav, behuk anum lashem, begevat Shaul, bechir Hashem. Right? They know exactly what, look how many times they use the Shem Hashem, right? They use the Shem Hashem twice in one pasuk. Is this blasphemy on their part? Is this like a hyper-principled revenge on their part? Not so clear, right? But they want blood. And the fact that it was these seven descendants are innocent, they didn't do anything themselves, is shot, that doesn't matter to them. They're out for blood, right? They want blood revenge. Anayomazeh, you have this in the Arab societies, right? Where you have these blood feuds that can go on for generation after generation. And that is the attitude of the Givonim. They're not interested in David's offer of peace. They're not interested in David's offer of compensation. They want blood. And you can see how the Navi captures how David is torn by this, because what he's doing, this is so rare, right? You see how we have a break smack in the middle of Pasuk Vav. And they say we want seven men from his descendants. And then there's a Ptucha, right? We skip the end of the line. So David is like, he's torn. What's he going to do? On the one hand, this is a horrible thing for them to ask for, totally unjustified. On the other hand, Hashem clearly has brought famine. So David, after the hesitation, Yomer HaMelech, Ani Etein, I will deliver them. Now, welcome to the fun decisions that a king gets to make. You know, it's not an easy job. Okay, so that's the first major piece over here. Now, there are a lot of people read the Pesukim here, and I think are critical of David HaMelech. I think the pshat in the Pesukim here, you don't really see criticism of David in the Pesukim. It really sounds like David, definitely Chazal read it this way, I think for good reason. What choice did he have? The famine is there. It seems totally unfair, but what alternative did he have? What clear option was he supposed to do other than this? The real thrust in the Pesukim here, as we're going to see, is going to be to contrast those who do chesed and those who don't do chesed. I'll have a little bit of a twist on who exactly those people are, but it doesn't really seem to be out to blast David. It seems out to blast the Givon. One piece that I forgot to... Well, you know what? Okay, let's hold that for now. We got to come back to one comment from Rashi, but we'll do that. We'll do that later. Okay. So what happens? And the Navi tells us, "Le'achmol haMelech al Mephibosheth ben Yehonasan ben Shaul." Why? Al Shvuat Hashem Asher ben Osam ben David ben Yehonasan ben Shaul. So David refuses to hand over Mephibosheth because of the oath that he and Yehonasan had taken. So you see, the Navi is contrasting David with Shaul. Right? The Navi is not criticizing David here. Shaul, a couple of Pesukim earlier, had ignored the oath B'nai Yisrael had made to give him. Again, understandably so, but bottom line, he ignored the oath of Yehoshua to the Givonim. And that is contrasted with David, who is loyal to the Shvuat Hashem that he had made with Yehonasan. He is not going to give up Mephibosheth. Now, unfortunately, that's a zero-sum game. If he's not going to give up Mephibosheth, he has to give up someone else instead. And so the Navi says he took the two sons of Ritzba Bas Ayah, who we met earlier in Shmuel Beis, right? She was the Pilegesh who Avner ben Ner allegedly slept with, and that precipitated his break with Ishbosheth. So Ritzba Bat Ayah has not had an easy time in Sefer Shmuel Beis. And she was used as a political pawn in the beginning of Shmuel Beis, and now her two sons, and it sounds like these are her only two sons, right? It sounds like she has two sons, and they're both taken. And the five children of Michal Bas Shaul, right? So this is kind of shocking, because it says, Chameshas b'nei Michal Bas Shaul, Asher Yaldala Adriel ben Barzilai Hamcholati. The problem here is that Michal was not married to Adriel ben Barzilai. It was Michal's older sister, Meirav, who was originally supposed to marry David HaMelech, right? So Rashi quotes Chazal, who explained that Meirav had died young. These children had been orphaned. Michal had taken them as her own. The pshad in the Pesukim was that Michal never had a child of her own. She raises the five children of Meirav. And so now, here's the choice that David was left with. Does he take the son of his best friend, Yehonasan? Does he take the adopted children of his wife, Michal? Right? It's horrible. I mean, it is absolutely horrible. But those are the seven that he takes. You know, we should also appreciate the Givonim were probably not very happy about this, because the main person the Givonim must have been interested in was Mephibosheth. Why? Well, they want to destroy the house of Shaul. Well, you know, in the patrilineal world, Ben Achar Ben, the only patrilineal real descendant of the house of Shaul here is Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth, the son of Yehonasan, the son of Shaul. The other seven, five of them are sons of a daughter, so that does not rank as high on the Givonim's, you know, revenge card. And the other two are sons of a Pelegesh, a secondary wife. So it is not only that David is withholding Mephibosheth, but here he is drawing a real line in the sand against the Givonim. The main source of the house of Shaul is going to remain. And as we've seen before, this is going to pay massive, I mean, massive is like a dumb word, like unbelievable dividends for Bnei Yisrael, because who is ultimately going to come from the house of Shaul? Who is ultimately going to come from Mephibosheth ben Yehonasan? Not only many, many, many brave and powerful soldiers who are described in Divrei Hayamim, but Mordechai and Esther. Okay, but David feels he has no choice. As difficult as it could be to understand the situation over here, he has to take those seven children, including the Ratzon of Ribon Shalom. The Radak points out that when the Torah says that Lo Yimusu Avos Al Banim and Banim Alavos, we don't penalize the children for the sons of the fathers. That's when it comes to a flesh and blood Bezdin. But Hashem does visit sons punishment on the next generation. Poked Avos Al Banim. We know that's a massively complicated topic, but at least just for now, the basic point is that that is what's happening over here. I mean, look what's happening. Literally, Bnei Yisrael, the next generation, is suffering because of what happened with Shaul in the previous generation. Okay, so Shaul, so David gives the seven to the Givonim, and what do the Givonim do? So Vayoki Bahar Lifnei Hashem, right? So they hang them before Hashem. What does that mean, before Hashem? The pshat is that it is before the Mishkan. The Mishkan, after the destruction of the Mishkan of Nov, is now in Givon. So what the Givonim do is they hang up, right? They murder and hang up the sons of Shaul, like across the street from the Mizbeach, Lifnei Hashem, right before the Mishkan. Again, is this being done out of just total blasphemy? Is this being done out of some warped sense of principled revenge? You know, they said to David, the Bechir Hashem, Shaul was Hashem's chosen king, and now we're going to take his seven sons, and look, we want our revenge, we're going to hang them up in front of the Mishkan. The line of thought which places emphasis on the destruction of Nov Ir HaKohanim is also well positioned to understand why this is over here. All right, they're going to say, our Givoni ancestors were murdered in the destruction of the Mishkan. Mida keneged mida, we are going to murder Shaul's descendants in front of the Mishkan. Right? Either way, we see why the Lifnei Hashem piece is over here. Okay. Then after that, just total cruelty of the Givonim. So then the Navi tells us just an unbelievable piece of chesed. From the beginning of the harvest season, right, until the entire summer, and would not allow the birds, right, to rest on the slain, right. So for what, like seven months, Ritzba 24/7 is out there defending the seven bodies, not only those of her two sons, but also the five sons of Merab. It's dry, so. Shot is that the bodies are not decomposing. There's no rain in the summer, and she's keeping the animals away from them. And it's just an unbelievable act of chesed shalemes, right? The Navi pretty clearly is contrasting the cruelty of the Givonim with the heroic chesed of Ritzvah. The Navi tells us that David is told about what's happening. I do not understand. It's difficult to know how David doesn't know about this, how nobody bothers to tell David the news about what's happening in Givon for 7 months. I don't understand that, but clearly David is told what happens 7 months later. What happens immediately after that's done, after he finds out what the Givonim were up to? So he takes the bones of Shaul, the bones of Yonasan, and the bones of the bodies of the seven slain descendants of Shaul, and he brings them to the kever of Shaul's family. And it's after that that Hashem actually brings the rain. So make one point and one question. The point, it's a very, very interesting suggestion that also Rav Meidan makes. I think if it's true, it will actually enrich the entire parak. This woman, Ritzvah Bas Aya. So who exactly is she? Well, he points out that we find the name Aya one other place in Tanakh. Nobody knows it because it's that parak at the end of Vayishlach where it's Esav's descendants. And it goes through the whole family in Seir. And so, right, one of the wives who Esav had was Ada Bas Elon Hachiti, and there was Alivama Bas Ana Bas Tzivon Hachivi. So, who was Esav's Chivi father-in-law, Ana? Who is this guy? So, the Pasuk tells us a little bit afterwards. There was somebody in Seir whose name was Tzivon. Again, he's a Kanani. And he had two brothers, Aya and Ana. And Ana was a very successful person. He's the one who marries his daughter off to Esau. So the name Aya, suggests Rav Meidan, we see, is not a Jewish name. It is a Canaanite name. Now, we can't be 100% confident in that because look at the name of somebody else in that parak. Alivama, who are her kids? So she has Yeush, Yalam, Korach. Okay. So there's a Korach there. We know that's a Jewish name, but hey, Esav named, that's Esav. Esav did the name. So it could be that Esav named his kid Korach, so it could be it's a Hebrew name. So his suggestion is that Ritzba Bas Aya, and by the way, why was she a Pilegesh? So he suggests that as happens really throughout Sefer Melachim, part of the politics is that the kings do marry wives from outside of Bnei Yisrael, and especially Pilegeshim from outside of Yisrael, so that they can create some basic family connection. Rabbi Dan suggests that Ritzba Bas Aya actually was a Gioris. Now, if that's the case, then that, I think, really deepens the broader message of the parak. Because what Chazal certainly focus on is the cruelty of the Givonim. And they really zero in on the line, Asher lo mibnei Yisrael heim. Right? They are not from Bnei Yisrael. Says Rashi right there on the spot. They show the cruelty they have. Right, and this is why David makes a gzera. David decrees on the spot. The Gemara Yevamos talks about this. Shelo yavo b'kahal. Givonim cannot intermarry into Bnei Yisrael after this. Amar. I put this in the Gemara. We're going to put this in the Rashi. Shlo shesanu yesh ba'umazo. There are three signs for a Jew. Rachmanim. By Shanim Begomle Chasadim, they have mercy, they have humility or modesty, they do love and kindness. Halalu, Ra'ui Lidabekbo. And there's somebody who has those signs who should be able to join the Kahal, someone who doesn't should not. And they give Givonim the cruelty they have, Lo Mibnei Yisrael. So one way to read what's happening here in the first half of the parak is contrast the Givonim with Bnei Yisrael. Look at what they do, right? Look at what they do, the blood revenge they have. Look what they do, leaving the bodies up for months, because even it's bad enough to murder the children of this Ritzvah Bas Aya, but now they're going to make her watch as the bodies decompose out in the open. And that is contrasted with the chesed of David, first, to Mephibosheth, and second, the chesed shel Emes, when he buries all the bodies of Shaul, Yonasan, and the seven, along with the chesed of Ritzvah Bas Aya, right? So we have the cruelty of the Givonim contrasted with the chesed of David and of Ritzvah. If Rav Meidan is correct, though, we can take it one step further and say, no, look, who is Ro'i Lida Beikbo? Right? You don't have to be born Jewish, but you know who is somebody who was not born Jewish, who was fit indeed, had the ethics and the morals and the values to join the Jewish people? Ritzvah Bas Aya. You don't have to have the genetics of Avram Yitzchak and Yaakov to join Bnei Avram Yitzchak and Yaakov. You have the chesed of David. You have the even greater chesed of Ritzvah. So we're really contrasting the Givonim, who were Canaanim and stayed Canaanim in a value sense, and Ritzvah, Bas Aya, who was maybe born Canaani, but goes in the ethical value direction of Bnei Yisrael. You know, the Ramban has a view. We know that there's a mitzvah to bury the dead. You're not allowed to leave someone hanging up after nightfall. The Ramban thinks that there's a second lav, Mida Oraisa, against doing that in Eretz Yisrael. That it's not just, you know, it's like we have a double chiddush. The Torah is double chiddush about the kavod for a dead body. Number one, the universal respect for the Tzelem Elokim. And number two, the idea that the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael is such that it cannot tolerate the cruelty to the dead. A Chesed Shel Emes is generally essential and Eretz Yisrael super essential, right? And what's happening here with Ritzvah and with David is that emphasis on the Chesed, which is inherent in Kedushas Yisrael. And if Rav Meidan is correct, then the Navi is also reminding us that one could be somebody who has the values of that Kedusha and fully join that Kedusha, even though they were not born into it. Now, we should wonder one point, which is, why was it, if the famine was caused because of what Shaul did in killing the Givonim, so why does the Navi only say Vayeyaser Elohim la'aretz achrechin? That Hashem was right. He listened to the tefilos. Why does that only happen months after Shaul's grandchildren were killed? Why does it only happen after the burial of Shaul and Yehonasan and the seven sons? So you could say, yeah, well, what does it mean Hashem answers the tefillah? Answering the tefillah means Hashem brings rain. So no, Hashem answered the tefillah when they killed the seven sons, but it was not the rainy season yet. Now the rainy season comes along and now Hashem brings the rain. But that's not what the Navi seems to say, right? The Navi seems to say that it was after David buried Shaul, Yehonasan, right? And it was only afterwards that Hashem brought the rain. So why is that also necessary? So Rashi is aware of this, and Rashi has a comment which really puts, I think, the perfect capstone on Shaul for us as we go forward as we in the Sefer. And I think after this, we really have nothing else to say about Shaul. Rashi noted that when the Navi introduced the problem, so the Navi said, what's wrong? Le'yom Hashem el Shaul ve'el beis hadamim asher himeses ha-givon. So it sounds like the problem is Shaul, what Shaul did. But Rashi says, no, there's a bifurcation. Hashem is telling David there are two problems. There's a problem of Shaul, and there's a problem of what Shaul did. What does that mean? Says Rashi, El Shaul, Al Avon Shaul Shenikbar Pit'om Behechave. Bnei Yisrael sinned by burying Shaul in secret. He was the Bechir Yisrael, the Bechir Hashem, the Mashiach Hashem. He deserved a state funeral in his plot in the land of Binyam. And the second problem was Al Beis Hadamim, that he destroyed the city of Nov, Ir HaKohan. And where's the line that Rashi? Where's the line that Rashi has? I hope I bolded it. Ba'al. Here we go. Here's the line. Ba'al tatama. Don't think this is bizarre. Shaharei Hashkadosh Baruch Hu tavei kavod v'tavei sechono. So Hashem is at first demanding Shaul's kavod, and then he's demanding Shaul's disgrace. Well, the two punishments are because the two sins are that Bnei Yisrael did not give Shaul enough kavod, and simultaneously that we have to hand over Shaul's descendants to the Gibbonim to murder them. What's going on there? And he says, yeah. Asher Shaul Palo, Basher Mishpato, Sham Palo, Kach Shem Yivamos. That indeed, those two things can happen simultaneously, right? And that really is the perfect way to think of Shaul. Shaul is such a complicated mix. You know, there is a lot that is problematic in Shaul. There's a reason why he's rejected. But there also is a lot of good. There's a lot of good. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu at the same time, Tovea Kivodo, the Tovea Serchon. And at the end of the day, which one is the more important one? What is the one where Hashem actually turns around and answers the tefillos of Bnei Yisrael? It is after they then go back and take Shaul and take Yehonasan and take the seven grandsons and give them the proper burial with kavod in the land of Binyam. Right. So really this piece just ends with the complexity of Shaul. I think we would say about Shaul that, you know, Yatza Hafsedo Bischaro, that there's more to his benefit than to his the problem. Now, so the few minutes we'll see the end of the parak. And in some ways, I think it clearly is related. So Navi now tells us about a whole bunch of battles that Bnei Yisrael had with the Plishtim. And again, this happened long ago, right? Way before Avshalom and Uriah, etc. Now the first battle here, David is involved in the actual combat. The Navi says, "Vayaaf David," right? David gets exhausted. And then there was somebody, Yishbi Binov. So Chazal jump in on this one. And Chazal see the Nov Iran Kohanim strand that we saw in the previous part of the Parak. They see this here as well. And they say, it's not a coincidence that the giant who's attacking David is named Yishbi Binov. They say that this is David being punished because he contributed to the destruction of Nov, as David himself actually admitted explicitly back when Evyasar, the last survivor of the Nov Kohanim, fled to David. And David said, I saw Doeg Adomi, I knew what was going to happen, and I messed up. So that's one piece. And he is from the Yelidei HaRafa. Okay, that's all who's there in a second. Now he has, like, I think four of these different stories. This one, Avishai ben Tsruya comes, right? So he's David's nephew. David is exhausted, and this giant, this is basically a capstone to the Goliath story. Right here, now David is a king, but David needs help. So he's helped by his nephew, Avishai ben Tsruya. Okay, they kill the Plishti, and then David's men swear to him, saying, "Lo teitzi odi tamal machama, lo tachabes ner Yisrael." You can't go to war, you can't extinguish the lamp of Israel. We kind of see here David coming full circle. Right, we see the maturation of the monarchy. David began fighting against Goliath. You know, David kind of concludes where his role as Melech is in a positive way. He's the Ner Yisrael, right? He has matured to the degree where the king is not supposed to be. This isn't like some story in Homer where the king is the best fighter. No, we move on from that. His job is to lead Bnei Yisrael. His job is Tzedek v'Mishpat, and his soldiers tell him, "We do the fighting. We do not want you extinguished." Okay. We have like three or four of these other people. Yelidei HaRafa. These are serious Yelidei HaRafa, these giants. One is killed by Sibchai HaChushati. Okay. Then this is a bit of a problem because there's somebody named Goliath. So that sounds very familiar. So he is killed by Elchanan ben Ya'ari from Beis Lechem. So what's going on there? So Rashi suggests that Elchanan ben Ya'ari actually is David himself. But others suggest, no, there's someone else named Goliath. You know, makes sense. A lot of Plishtim were naming their kids Goliath. And Elchanan from Beis Lechem is a relative of David's. Then there's another relative of David's who kills another giant, Yonasan ben Shima, Achi David, another one of David's nephews. We actually met earlier the brother of this guy. If you remember in the story of David and Amnon, or Tamar and Amnon. Remember, Amnon had a best friend who was exceptionally wise. So he was Yonadav ben Shima. So Yonadav ben Shima may have been very wise, but a problematic personality. Yehonasan, his brother, was the one who actually helped David fight against these Plishtim. Okay, so now what is the overall takeaway from these, like, you know, David's relatives killing Plishti giants and the echo of the Goliath story? So there are two basic messages you can take depending on who this Rafa is. Who are the Yelidei HaRafa? Rashi gives us one explanation that he assumes, and Radak gives the other. Rashi says, and we're all familiar with this, that these were the descendants of Orpah, right? Orpah, the sister of Rus. What's the idea? These are the descendants of Orpah. So we have the descendants of Rus, David and his whole family, right? His nephew, his other nephew, his cousin, whoever Elchanan ben Ya'ari exactly is, against the family of Orpah. Now, so think about this, and especially in light of the previous half of Parak, if we really think that, the story of the Givonim was definitely contrasting Kedushas Yisrael with the Givonim, and we have those who do chesed and those who do not do chesed, we can certainly understand why Rus, the paradigm of chesed, would be somebody that we would want to introduce into the story, especially if Ritzpah bat Ayah actually was a Gioras, then it's a perfect contrast, right? We have the two Kenanim in the picture, the two non-Jews. We have the cruel Givonim, and we have the Gioras and the Chesed of Ritzvah Basaya. That is a perfect transition to Rus and Arpa, who are both born to Moab, but Rus joins Bnei Yisrael, and she is the paradigm of Chesed, the paradigm of the values of the Yavos and the Himahos, whereas Arpa goes back, and then, you know, if you see her as the mother or whatever, the ancestor of these Plishti giants, right? So we see that's clearly going in the opposite direction. So that's one way to look at this really parag as a cohesive unit, and the stress is on Kedushas Yisrael, Chesed as the prime value of that, and then you don't need to be genetically a part of Bnei Yisrael to be part of Kedushas Bnei Yisrael. Rus exemplify that better than anybody else. The other possibility, though, the Radak quotes from the Targum that the Yilidei HaRafa, he says, what's the Rafa? The Rafa is not Arpa. It's a fascinating drash, and there's a lot to say about it. He says, the Rafa, that's like the Yilidei HaAnak, right? The giants. Ruachad min HaRifaim. This is one of the old giants that the Meraglim had to face and had to deal with. So these are the leftovers. So what's happening here then is we look at what's happening over here with David mopping up the conquest of Yehoshua. What did Yehoshua tell us? Say for Yehoshua. So Yehoshua wipes out the Anakim, Min Hahar, Min Chevron, all of the land of Yehuda. All of those giants, all of those Anakim were wiped out by Yehoshua, with one exception, the Navi said. Lo nosar anakim be'eretz Yisrael, rak be'aza, be'gas, u'ashdod nisharu. In the cities of the Plishtim, Yehoshua was not able to conquer the city of the Plishtim, and he was not able to wipe out those anakim. So the way that Radak and the way the Targum are understanding these Yilidei HaRafa is that now along comes David, his whole family, and they are finishing the job. What we're seeing here is the conquest, is the completion. Our limud of this parak. Point number one is to link this back with what we saw, the theme we saw in the end of the David and Avshalom war, where the Navi in a few different instances was linking David with Yehoshua, right? And there the idea was that this is a reconquest of Eretz Yisrael. Now we're saying, yeah, and David, you know, Yehoshua did most of the job, but it wasn't actually completed. The ultimate goal, the three mitzvos Bnei Yisrael have are, set up a king, wipe out a malik, build a Beis HaMikdash. And now we know that David has basically either accomplished or set up to accomplish all three. But this parak tells us we also completed the actual conquest of Eretz Yisrael. You know, we conquered Yerushalayim, got rid of the Kananim, and now we're getting rid of these Kananim, you know, here, these Anakim in the land of the Plishtim. One last point that we can suggest is that the Navi may not only be linking David with Yehoshua, but the Navi may also be contrasting David with Shaul. Right? The Navi contrasted David with Shaul in the first half of the parak, where David was the one who kept his shvua, he kept his oath to David, to Yonas, I'm sorry, while Shaul broke the oath of Yehoshua. We also can say then that, you know, we look at Shaul and Yehonasan, at the Shaul and David. Both of them are trying to complete the legacy of Yehoshua. Both of them are trying to get rid of the last Plishtim and leave Bnei Yisrael secure in the land militarily, but also ethically. But as is so often the case, Shaul tries to do it, but he does it in the wrong way. What Shaul does ends up being not a completion of the mission of Yehoshua, but it ends up being a repudiation of the mission of Yehoshua. The massive Kiddush Hashem that Yehoshua had accomplished by honoring his oath to the Givonim, Shaul destroyed. And in contrast, David tries to do it, but he's doing it the right way, right? He is indeed finishing off the rest of the Anakim, and even though he's not doing it himself, he's doing it with his greater family. So it's a very challenging parak and a lot of questions and lingering issues. But I think the main points to think about, the centrality of chesed versus cruelty that the Navi puts a spotlight on, and thinking of this as really coming full circle in David's career, come full circle from the Goliath story, full circle of the conquest of Eretz Yisrael, I think those are some firm points we can hang our hat on. Okay, so we'll stop here, and God willing, looking forward to more learning next week.
Thank you.
Take care, everybody.
Thank you. Are we going to have?
Thank you. Always yes. Wonderful.
Thank you. We will. We'll go through. Yeah, we're definitely going to meet next week, and I think we got it. We got to keep going until we finish the safe. So we'll have a couple more classes to finish the safe. We're almost there. Home stretch.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. Bye, everybody.